Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 283 for Friday, January 3rd, 2014. Well, I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts again, not downtown Denver, and tonight we're getting a big blizzard here in Cambridge, whereas it's almost, I think it was in the 50s today, Darlene told me. So this was an unplanned visit to be with my father, who's in nearby Mount Auburn Hospital. He is going to be 87 next month, and at Christmas time he came down with a bad chest cold, and then that was followed by a fall in which he fractured a small bone in his foot, and that led to a trip to the ER where they discovered his blood sodium level was dangerously low. So it's been kind of a one thing after another, and he's always in pretty good spirits despite all this, but I'm glad I could be here and be with him in the hospital for 3 days and before I head off. I'm going to be here until Saturday under the current plan, and that's when I go back west to attend the last 2 days of the annual three-day Woodstock for Podcasters, also known as New Media Expo in Las Vegas. In the midst of Dad's medical setbacks, which we were monitoring closely from Denver, Darlene and I were carless in Denver until after sometimes sharp differences of opinion, we agreed on another Ford Focus as our new Denver wheels. That's the same car that we decided to leave here in Cambridge instead of driving back and forth twice a year. As I was testing the recording levels for this week's interview with preacher Mark Roberts, I mentioned the Carmageddon marital disputes that were going on then in full swing, and he offered graciously to pray for us in his professional capacity. And, you know, that may in fact have actually led that evening to a surprisingly satisfactory car deal. Our negotiations that evening at Freeway Ford in Denver were facilitated by my old friend Leroy Peterson, who used to buy fleet vehicles at the gas company where I worked in Casper, Wyoming. So we're sitting there in the salesman's cubicle, and we've got Leroy in Virginia, looped in by my iPhone speaker, and Dustin, the head sales guy at the Ford place, immediately detected that he was dealing with a pro. He and Leroy did a respectful, friendly, hard-bargaining tango toward a good year-end deal for both sides. One of my favorite moments in the negotiation came when Dustin put his last number down on paper for the two-year lease that we wanted, and I couldn't tell how big a difference it represented from what we had last offered. "That's a sandwich, Len," Leroy told us from the speaker, meaning that we were the cost of a sandwich apart. "Does that mean we have your blessing, Leroy?" Dustin asked the iPhone with a grin aimed in my direction. "Yup," Leroy said. I shook Dustin's hand, and perhaps miraculously, we drove off in a new ruby-red Focus that we're both pretty happy with. Darlene named her Molly because she liked the sound of it, so Molly it is. As I say, this all took place just a few hours after interviewing Mark Roberts, who, as we were chatting, setting up the levels for the interview, he made it clear that he understands the stress that a couple can face shopping for a car. So here's essentially an outtake just before the actual interview.
"Maybe I'll add you to my prayer list, especially your marriage. Buying cars, why is that so hard? You know, if you went to the grocery store and you said, 'I want to buy a head of lettuce,' and the guy said, 'Mr. Edger, I can get you in this lettuce today. How much are you willing to go?' You just write this number down and I'll get you." Like, really?
In the interview itself, you will hear Mark Roberts discuss his pastoral experiences with the Kindle and ebooks, and he will weigh in on the question of whether the sacredness of the Bible is affected or diminished when the book is encountered digitally. I'm putting this episode together tonight in Cambridge and in my parents' kitchen at their home during this big blizzard, and so it's kind of a compressed schedule. I really want to be clear of the podcast by tomorrow so I can spend most of the day at the hospital helping out as best I can before leaving for Las Vegas. So that means I'm going to move more organically through the usual topics, and I may not actually hit the magic mark of 44:58 because of these unusual circumstances. Let's jump in, and we'll start out with some news. Izzy from Australia, a longtime listener, sent me a link to coverage of the new Yoda phone that's from Russia, and I've actually seen one of these at the tour that I took of the E-Ink Research center that opened this fall in Billerica, Massachusetts, not far from Cambridge. But this was the first I'd seen a review of it. This is features an editor from CNET talking about the phone. And here's the audio of it from CBS.
A Russian company is out with a dual-screen smartphone. The Yoda phone comes with all the features that you'd expect on the front side, but on the back, there's an electronic paper screen, like the kind you'd find on the e-readers. Dan Ackerman is senior editor for our partners at CNET and joins us at the table with two of the phones that you can't get anywhere else. Should we be surprised, Dan, that it's coming from a Russian company? I don't think most people think of Russia's technology-driven.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff coming out of there, a lot of startups, a lot of development, people willing to take risks on new stuff where maybe you wouldn't see something so different from an American phone company.
And what's the attraction to the two screens?
You know, I think the appeal is you have your regular kind of, you know, phone screen on the front, and on the back you have something that's kind of like a Kindle screen. So it's e-ink, which means it's black and white, but a lot of people like these screens for long-form reading because they're very easy to read, they're easy on the eyes, and they don't use a lot of battery power, so you can just leave it up all the time, and it's not going to kill your phone battery.
Are other companies looking at ways to sort of reinvent the smartphone?
That's kind of the problem that we have right now. I think we've hit a plateau. All the phones are kind of the same. There's these big glass slabs, about 5-inch screen. Right. They take good photos. They go on the internet. They have fast connections. So what's the next step? It's hard to figure out what the next big leap forward is. And this is at least a candidate.
Why would you need a Kindle-like screen on the back of your phone?
You know, I think if you read a lot of books on your phone, like I'm on the train all the time, it's at the Kindle app. It's easier to read an e-ink screen. That's why people still buy the regular Kindles. And it's great for battery life. If you put either a book on there or even like a shopping list or directions, it'll just stay on and it's not going to pull down your battery. And that's really one of the problems people have with phones these days is they don't even last all day anymore.
Do you think people like Samsung and Apple are taking notes right now? Or do you just think that this is a gimmick and isn't really going to catch on?
You know, this first version of phone is definitely kind of gimmicky. We've been playing around with it. It doesn't quite work, you know, exactly the way you'd expect a consumer device to work right now. But everyone is keeping an eye on this. Some of the other companies are trying their own kind of weird ideas like curved phones or flexible phones that, you know, fit better against your face. Everyone's trying to figure out what the next big thing is that's going to make you want to go out and get a new phone.
This is not in the U.S. market yet. When might it be, and why isn't it yet?
This is a Russian phone that's available there and in a big chunk of Europe right now. There are no plans to bring this to the U.S. right now. You kind of need a deal with a big carrier to get that subsidized $200 price, because right now it's, you know, $600, the same as pretty much any phone is if you buy it off contract. I don't think they have the clout to get in with the American carriers yet.
I'll have a link to that video clip in the show notes. I was kind of surprised that they didn't announce the or talk about the reports of a Kindle phone coming, and that's coming pretty quickly, according to the reports that we were seeing last year, sometime in the spring maybe of 2014. And given how supportive Amazon has been of the e-ink technology with the original Kindles, and they're, you know, continue to make advances with the Paperwhite, it strikes me that you might very well see some kind of a Kindle screen on a Kindle phone, an e-ink screen on a Kindle phone, and maybe there'd be some version of the Yoda phone involved in this new Kindle phone. But they've also been talking about weird 3D displays, and this thing is just a total unknown as to what on earth a Kindle phone might look like. When I think about the possibilities of an e-ink screen on one side of a phone, and I did get a chance to actually hold one of these things. It wasn't running, so I couldn't test it. But the fact that you can have an e-ink display last essentially forever without using any electricity, it only uses electricity when it changes. I thought, you know, if you had a to-do list and you wanted to have one side of your phone have that page from your Evernote or your Getting Things Done list of things for next actions, that could be a use for it. If you wanted to print out some directions and just have it on the phone on sort of a paper-like way rather than using maps or a GPS. There'd just be a lot of different ways that you could use that screen that didn't change much and also have all the abilities to browse the web or check email on the LCD side of the phone. So I find this very intriguing, and I think it'd be cool if there was some sort of an Amazon version of this, or that this was kind of pointing the way to something creative that Amazon might be doing in this space where people are trying to figure out what's the next great thing in a smartphone. Several articles in the last week have pointed toward the scale of Amazon's apparent success in the holiday season, and there was also an overall report in the company that suggested Amazon's stock is still a good investment, even at the pretty high stock prices of late. Amazon stock was up 55% from the first close in January to the last close in December when it closed at $398.79 a share. There was an analysis of what's ahead for Amazon stock, kind of an analyst report at WallStreetCheatSheet.com by Victor Mora on January 1st. The three categories that they apparently analyze stocks fall into: outperform, wait and see, or stay away. I think that would translate to buy, hold, or sell. Seems like that's a more common way to differentiate stocks. To cut to the quick of this analysis, they rate Amazon in the outperform category. Look for Amazon to outperform is the way they describe it. Some of it is fairly technical, analyzing calls and puts and graphs of data, the moving averages. There isn't so much a sector-by-sector analysis of the company. It's more kind of a technical analysis. One thing which I hadn't seen before in mentioning the UPS troubles of getting all of Amazon's packages delivered, and also mentioning that FedEx had some similar problems, this writer refers to, quote, speculation that companies like Amazon will soon take delivery into their own hands to avoid future Christmas catastrophes. Interesting idea. Amazon trucks driving packages around as well as drones. And given the stakes of having a successful holiday season, who knows, that might well be the case. And finally, in news, this isn't really something that surfaced this past week or even in the past year, but I did come across a wonderful blog post while I was up in the middle of a recent night reading on my Kindle Paperwhite in bed. I happened to be reading the latest issue of the New York Review of Books, and I searched for the term Kindle, which is something I ought to do more frequently, because it came up with a reference to a blog post by an author named Tim Parks, who I didn't know. And it showed up, the search results showed up in a profile of Parks and a thoughtful review of his latest novel, which is titled Sex is Forbidden. The author of this review, James Walton, began by stating that Tim Parks has never been a man to take any received wisdoms for granted, however blameless they might appear. As examples of this, Walton cited Parks' dismissal of the widely revered novelist Salman Rushdie as, quote, something of a lightweight crowd pleaser. That would be a distinctly minority evaluation of Salman Rushdie. He's a pretty widely respected novelist, and of course he came into some real personal danger in his life when Iran put a fatwa on him for one of his novels. The sentence that came after that is what made it impossible for me to go back to sleep for another hour until I had tracked down the reference. More heretically still, Walton wrote, last year he, meaning Parks, wrote a disturbingly persuasive blog post arguing that the Kindle offers a more austere and therefore grown-up literary experience than those gaudy, self-congratulatory objects known as books. Well, I snuck out to my studio without waking up Darlene or the Yorkie Claire and quickly found the blog post, which was referred to in that article. It's titled "E-books Can't Burn," published in the New York Review of Books blog on February 12th, 2012. I will have a link to this post, which I did indeed find not disturbingly persuasive, but thrillingly so, because it confirmed a sense that I've had since the very beginning about the higher quality of reading that is possible on an e-ink Kindle. Here are some key parts of Parks' argument in that blog post. He talks a little bit about the history of publishing in books, and then he gets to the part which really makes the case, saying the literary experience does not lie in any one moment of perception or any physical contact with a material object, even less in the possession of handsome masterpieces lined up on our bookshelves, but in the movement of the mind through a sequence of words from beginning to end. He had a kind of an argument here, which I haven't seen anyone else mention in this. You know, all kinds of discussion about the role of the book in literature. He says, what about a memorized poem? He says, memorized, a poem is as surely a piece of literature in our minds as it is on the page. So there you've taken the poem, the poet's words and the word choices, all the way out of a book, not even in an e-book, but in the person's mind who memorized it. And is that literature? Where does that rank in kind of the appreciation of literature that you hear talked about in books versus e-books? He really gets rolling when he writes, "The ebook, by eliminating all variations in the appearance and weight of the material object we hold in our hand, and by discouraging anything but our focus on where we are in the sequence of words, the page once read disappears, the page to come has yet to appear, would seem to bring us closer than the book to the essence of the literary experience." He continues, "Certainly it offers a more austere, direct engagement with the words appearing before us and disappearing behind us than the traditional book offers, giving no fetishistic gratification as we cover our walls with famous names. It is as if one had been freed from everything extraneous and distracting surrounding the text to focus on the pleasure of the words themselves. In this sense, the passage from paper to ebook is not unlike the moment when we pass from illustrated children's books to the adult version of the page that is only text. This is a medium for grown-ups." And then he ends with what is something I felt too, that just scratching his head about, when you see this and you believe it, that you're really seeing the essence of the writing more on an ebook page than you are on a book page. And why is it? He says, "It becomes harder and harder to see why the literati are not giving the phenomenon a more generous welcome." Well, maybe one day. It's just, but it does, it's, you know, most people in master fine arts programs like Bennington, the one I went to, are still really disdainful or worried or just have some kind of prejudice against ebooks. And you think of these people, of anyone, would be seeing and experiencing the different quality of reading that is possible. It probably wasn't a good thing to find this quote late at night, because it's been a while since I've been on this particular hobby horse and talking about McLuhan and how the ebook intensifies the visual aspect of the medium. But it did please me to come across this, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes. For the tech tip, I want to share a concern or a problem that was brought to my attention by Fred Ortel from Jacksonville, Florida. And he wrote, he shared a problem that came about because his Kindle was automatically updated with the software, and he shares his account with his wife. And they have had two different collections as ways to organize their content. But after the update, which went to the cloud collections across devices, all of a sudden they can only have one set of collections, and this was a problem. He wrote a letter to Amazon about this, or emailed them, and shared it with me. He wrote, "There are two Kindle Paperwhites in my account. It is a shame that with the new software update you made things worse. Now both Paperwhites are exactly the same. My wife and I cannot have independent collections. We were able to before your update. Why not make software updates optional, or at least go back to the way things were? You made using the Kindle not user-friendly, but more difficult." I can imagine that this would be a really tough question for Amazon developers or executives planning the platform to deal with, because Fred's obviously raising a legitimate problem that two customers have had who use their Kindles in a certain way and now they can't. But at the same time, I sometimes think that even with the current system where software updates are automatically put out wirelessly, or if you want it faster, you can download them manually from the site, across all of these devices, all of these apps, and different levels of features available on the iPad versus the Fire and the Paperwhite. And if you added to that complexity just among the devices, the ability for customers to kind of consciously choose not to update because they didn't want a specific feature like this cloud collection one. And then how would you manage the next improvement? Would they just be stuck there and then they would never get any more updates? There's kind of a fundamental design issue that I've heard Amazon executives like Russ Grandinetti talk about, with the really passionate commitment to make the platform simple for people who just want to read books. They don't want to be messing around with settings and software updates to begin with. And there has been historically a real preference for that kind of a user, as opposed to users like myself and Fred and probably a lot of people who listen to this podcast. We want to get in and tinker sometimes and really customize things and have all kinds of options. And when you have that kind of a platform, it can, if you're not careful in how you set it up, it can be pretty intimidating to the casual user, the people like my parents in their 80s who love to read, love their Kindles, and they don't really want to be bothered worrying about which software update they have. But in any event, this was an intriguing problem that Fred expressed in an articulate way. I'm sure it got some attention at Amazon, and maybe somewhere down the road there will be a chance to opt out of software updates. I think the problem too is that there's no path backward. You know, if you found that you had an update and it was doing things you didn't like, I think Fred was trying to find a way back, and he couldn't. If you knew one was coming, I suppose you'd keep your wireless connection off, but that's no good because you couldn't get into your archives, and sooner or later, the way these things are pushed out automatically, you're going to find the update on your Kindle even if you know you don't want it. So kind of a fascinating issue that has come up there. Mark Roberts, you may remember, is the longtime listener who overcame my initial reluctance at being the interview guest on my own podcast. That was back in March of 2013, and I thought he did a really good job as the interviewer. He is a devoted digital reader and a powerful preacher whose sermons you can hear at justchristians.com. That's his the West Side Church of Christ website. I spoke with Mark by Skype on Monday, December 30th, back when I was in Denver. I began by noting that he began his preaching at Westside Church of Christ at what struck me as an impressively young age, 28.
If that does seem kind of young, you have to remember that Churches of Christ don't have any kind of denominational structure. They're not part of any sort of central headquarters or board or conference. Each church is independent and autonomous. So a congregation can ask, you know, who they want to come preach for them, and if they feel like, you know, this is the fellow who can help them grow and serve the Lord in a better way, then they can ask you to come. And there's not necessarily any seminary requirements or so forth about that. So they asked me to come. By that time, I'd actually been preaching 7 years. I had been with three other congregations, so I had a little experience, and they felt I'd be a good fit with the congregation, and I'm very glad they asked me to come.
I was interested that on the website, when it refers to Westside Church of Christ, the word church is not capitalized. What's the significance of that?
Now that's actually a fairly subtle nuance that not a lot of people notice, but I am glad that you noticed that. We do that because in the Bible, the phrase Church of Christ isn't an official title. It's just a description of the people who belong to Jesus. So since it's not a proper noun, we don't capitalize it. Probably a good analogy to that is the way people use the word Coke. Sometimes when people say, I want a Coke, they mean the actual beverage bottled by the Coca-Cola bottling company. But sometimes people say, I want a Coke, and that means any fizzy brown carbonated beverage that you have. And when they say, I just want a Coke like that, you wouldn't capitalize it. So since we're not part of any denominational network, we don't use the term church as an official title, and not capitalizing it is one of the ways that we try to remind ourselves of the way the Bible uses the term church to be a descriptor and not, you know, an official title, and we want to use it that way as well.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about the Kindle. When did you start reading on a Kindle?
I started reading on the Kindle about 2 years ago. In fact, 2 years ago Christmas, my parents gave me what we now know as the Kindle keyboard. I think then it was called the Kindle 3G, and I just immediately fell in love with it. I thought it was the absolute greatest thing ever. And so 2 years now I've been reading on the Kindle.
You had some reservations before you received it. What were your reservations?
I must admit, when I first saw the Kindle, I thought, who would pay extra money for that? And why would anybody want that? It was a large, clunky device and so forth. Just didn't think a whole lot of the Kindle. How many books would be available? Come on, why would you want something like that? And then, of course, is they got to the second iteration of that, and they got more and more books. It became more attractive. A good friend of mine who also preaches, he had one, and he really liked it. And he talked to me about it and said, you've got to try this thing. And so Christmas time came, and I hoped I'd been a pretty good boy, and so I asked Santa Claus if he'd bring me one, and next thing you know, here I am, you know, reading on a Kindle all the time.
What were some of the first books that you downloaded and read on it?
Christmas Eve, we opened presents at my parents' that year at Christmas Eve, and the first thing I did was load up Sherlock Holmes. I couldn't believe, for 99 cents, the complete works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I'm a huge fan of The Great Detective, and now I had all of them right there. I was just ecstatic.
Now, according to your blog or some of your writing, there were some books that you were looking for on the Kindle that weren't available. What sorts of books were those?
Well, I was really looking for more religious books on the Kindle. Now, when someone releases a new book in print, it's practically a given that there will be a Kindle edition, but that wasn't nearly as common 2 years ago. That doesn't seem like that long ago, but in the Kindle sphere, it really is. Now, everything, it seems like, comes out in the Kindle sphere, but there just wasn't as much religious writing as I wanted.
And then that led you to create Pressing On, which is your monthly e-zine. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of that project.
Well, in a way, Lynn, you are responsible for the creation of Pressing On magazine. I was driving and listening to the podcast. That's that and running are the two ways that I hear the podcast. And so here you were talking to a guest about publishing on the Kindle. And I was thinking about how easy it is to email myself a document on my Kindle. And that all just came together. It just clicked. And I realized it would be fairly simple to create a magazine and email it right to people's Kindles. Now, that turned out to not really be exactly true. There's really nothing that simple about e-magazines. And in fact, you can employ companies to do that kind of work for you, which tells you that it's not an easy process at all. The first thing I learned is you cannot send an attachment to a long list of email subscribers because a lot of email servers won't take attachments and there's problems with that. So that didn't work. And then I learned that people have to authorize me to email onto their Kindle, and that is a whole process to train people in how to do that right. And then I discovered that formatting documents for Kindle is absolutely unbelievably fussy and complicated and persnickety. And so there's lots of work involved. But by November of 2012, we, and yes, there are other people besides just myself, we got our first issue of Pressing On magazine out. And it was really exciting to see that appear on my Kindle for the first time.
I went through that process where I validated your email address in the manage your Kindle area of my page at Amazon. Does that mean now that each monthly issue will show up automatically on the device that I gave you that email address for, or do you still have to kind of send a link to me by email and then I click and download?
It does mean that you will receive the magazine automatically. You don't have to do anything, touch anything, or click anything. Each month, the issue will arrive automatically on your Kindle. And people really, really love that a lot. And that's our goal, and that's how we wanted to do it. And we're really excited that it works that way. You will get the email that all subscribers get with other download options if you have other devices. And you can choose to read on other devices as well if you would like. But yes, if you have a Kindle and you register your Kindle, then kabang, it just arrives for you automatically.
And let's give listeners a taste of what types of content would somebody be receiving each month if they did subscribe to Pressing On.
We offer a number of columnists that are going to write on Bible themes and Bible topics, mostly on how the Bible relates to everyday life and how you can be a better disciple, the idea of pressing on in your service to the Lord. It's really not a theological magazine with a lot of really heavy content. It's really much more day-to-day living, marriage, family, kids, what the Bible has to say about that, prayer, worship, those kinds of issues. It's very fresh. Most of the articles are going to be about one page in length if you were looking at an 8.5 by 11 paper magazine. So it's an easy read, and we think there's some really, really good content.
And it's pretty reasonably priced. What's the subscription cost?
For $10 a year, you get a subscription, 12 issues. It comes automatically to you once a month. Now, some folks will ask about paper, and they want a paper magazine, and they want to know why we don't put it out on paper. And the answer to that is that $10 number that I just gave to you. Paper costs money, and then you have to print paper, and printing costs money, and then you have to put postage on the printed paper, and that costs more money. And there's just not any way that we could put together the content that we have. The magazine runs about 30 pages if you choose to print it out. And there's no way that I can put together 30 pages a month and mail it to people for $10 a year. That's a really exciting price point, I think. Email stamps are very inexpensive. And so we're very glad to be able to do that. But part of that then is it only is available in an e-format.
Yeah, makes sense. In your own personal reading and study of the Bible, are you on paper or reading on a Kindle or other tablet device? What's the mix of devices that you use when you're having your time with the Bible?
Well, if someone asks me if I'm paper or digital, the question is a good question, and the answer to that is going to be yes. I have a paper Bible, the one that's got a well-worn leather cover and all the highlighting and notes crammed in the margin, and that's the one that I read from the most and that I preach and teach from, and I love that Bible, and I love holding that Bible in my hand. But of course, it would be foolish for me not to take advantage of the wonders of technology that are available to us today. I have a very high-end and very powerful Bible package made by Logos Bible Software, and I use that constantly and all of the time. It enables me to search the Bible and read and compare translations and look at original languages, call up encyclopedias, dictionaries, commentaries, lexicons, just about anything else to help me better understand the message of Scripture. I have over 2,000 volumes in my Logos Bible Software library, and I can access that on my iPad and just use that all the time. That's a great and very valuable asset to me in my work. And then, of course, I have Bible programs on all my devices, on my Kindle keyboard, my Android phone, my iPad. So I can read the Bible anywhere that I am. That all of that goes to say that I'm a hybrid. I love reading my paper Bible. And I love reading it, especially because I have a lot of notes and highlighting in that Bible that helps me. But I use electronic Bibles all the time and think that they're wonderful and am very, very thankful for the opportunity to use those too.
Now, when you're preaching and you're looking out over the congregation and you always start out guiding them to a specific verse in the Bible, what percent of the people are flipping through paper Bibles versus some kind of an electronic device?
Right now, I would guess between a third to a quarter of the congregation is going to be reading on some kind of device. A tablet, the iPad by far is the most popular e-device that I'm going to see. So somewhere between a third to a fourth of the congregation is looking at the Bible on a screen. And I want to be very clear about that. I'm really okay with that. We've talked about that several times, and people ask me about that, and I've talked about that in the pulpit. Sometimes folks think Christians are kind of Luddites against anything that's new or different or technology, and that's absolutely not the case at all. People need to use the Bible in the form that they're comfortable with and that they can make use of. The Bible is a tool, and it needs to be practical, and if that works for you on a screen, there are some issues with the screen. I get that. I know about that. But if you can read it in that form and that's what's convenient and comfortable for you, then by all means, come on, just do that. And in fact, recently I was teaching our teenage devotional, and I got out my Bible and opened it, and I looked at all the kids, and they all had their phones out. And I was thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to have to get on to everybody, you know, put your phone away, get off of Facebook, stop your texting. And I realized they were following in their Bibles on their phones. That is their Bible. And so we had a great Bible study, me with paper and them with electronics, and it all worked out great.
That's good. Now, you and your wife put together a 5-day Bible reading program quite a while ago, over 25 years ago. Why did you decide to undertake that project?
Well, we're very focused on getting people in the Word of God and helping them to stay with that and to continue to read the scriptures. And it seemed to me that one of the barriers to that is the 7-day Bible reading programs where you read every day. If you miss a day, now you're behind. And if you miss 2 days, wow, you're really behind. And I think that causes people to give up. They realize as they look at the checkboxes that they're now 4,000 chapters behind, and they just say, okay, I'll start again next year, January 1st. And if there could be a little slack in the schedule, that would help people to be able to keep up with it better. And so my wife did the math. I'm terrible at arithmetic. And she did the math and helped me divide the Bible out into readings 5 days a week. And then we put that schedule together with some tweaks to it so that you can read through the Bible chronologically. Sometimes it makes a little bit more sense when you're reading it in that kind of fashion and you fit some things together in that sort of way. And we published that. We actually used to mail that out in envelopes with real stamps, and that was a lot of hassle. And now you can just download it, and there's a Kindle version available and just all kinds of things, and it just goes everywhere, and lots people have had good success in being able to stick with a Bible reading plan by this 5-day reading schedule.
And that's pretty reasonably priced as well, isn't it?
Yes, we give it away.
Then the Kindle version is 99 cents, which I guess is the minimum you can charge.
That's right. And I wish that I could give away the Kindle version, but I can't. You have to charge at least 99 cents, or you have to guarantee that you're not giving it away in any other format. If I would make it only available in Kindles, then I could make it a free book. But it's not just available to Kindles. You can get it as a PDF, and it's on the church's website, and I have a personal website it's on. There's just lots of places that you can find that. So since I can't guarantee it to be Kindle exclusive, I have to charge 99 cents. It's really maybe this is the wrong thing to say. It's really not very good on your Kindle because you can't check boxes on your Kindle.
What do you mean by that?
You can't check off the boxes as you read them.
I see.
And so you can certainly look and see what today's reading is and the dates are there and all that kind of stuff. But it's kind of nice to be able to check it off. So maybe if there's anything that's better in paper format, maybe the 5-day Bible reading schedule printed out is a little bit better. It folds up neatly and you stick it in the back of your Bible and it's just right there ready to go. And you can see that where you are in the progress that you've made and what you need to read for today.
Cool. I think I shared with you a link to the writer Thomas Larson, who was on the media, National Public Radio program, with a thought-provoking piece about whether the Bible becomes less holy or sacred when transformed into a variety of media, including movies, apps, and e-books. It was a little odd because he was coming at it not as a believer, but as somebody observing how the poor Bible is faring in this difficult digital age. What were your thoughts in reaction to his concerns? Are you worried that somehow e-books and these different ways of the Bible being communicated are undermining something sacred and essential to the Bible?
Well, I'm not as concerned as Mr. Larson is about that kind of thing. He's really concerned that the Bible, if it isn't read as a book, is somehow not going to be believed or somehow is not as sacred. But I think there are real problems with that line of reasoning. First, the Bible was held to be God's word and believed by people for centuries before most anyone ever owned their own personal copy of it. Indeed, the Bible didn't even start as a book, as a codex. It started as a scroll. And in Old Testament times, people heard the Bible read to them, like is found, for example, in Nehemiah the 8th chapter. They didn't go home and consult their own copy because such copies did not exist. So the Bible has fared very well before it ever became a book that individuals owned in their own home. So maybe what I would say about that is Mr. Twain's quotation fits very well here. The reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. The Bible is still viewed as a sacred and important book, and even the sacred and important book by most people. 9 out of 10 Americans own at least one Bible. 8 out of 10 Americans identify the Bible as sacred literature without any prompting from the interviewers, at least in one survey that I saw recently. So people seem very comfortable with the Bible and continue to accord the Bible great status. If Mr. Larson thinks that somehow the Bible is going to lose its force and meaning because people are reading it on a screen instead of paper, I don't seem to find any suggestion of that in any study or in any interview or polling done by anyone. And again, he needs to remember the Bible has gone through a number of shifts already. It began as a scroll. It then went on to become a codex, and now it is digital. It began in a time when it was not available to the common man, at least not very easily, to being much more commonly available, and then during the time of the Dark Ages to largely being shut away from ordinary people. To now, it's at a time where it is widely available to everyone and anyone. So somehow, one begins to wonder if maybe Mr. Larson needs to find something else to worry about. The Bible seems to be doing quite well down through time, and I suspect that the Lord will continue to make use of whatever technology comes about to further his word, because God gave us his word so that he can be made known, and he wants us to know his word. So Mr. Larson probably can rest easy. When God's on the job, things have a tendency to turn out okay.
Can you identify any parts of the Bible verses or that sort of give guidance on how the Bible message is meant to go forth in different technologies, different eras, that you could actually say, here's something from the Bible that gives us some insight into the matter of reading on a Kindle versus reading on papyrus or a scroll or anything else?
That's really a great question. And interestingly, the Bible does not mandate or address or say that it is, for example, to be copied on a certain kind of parchment, or that when it is to be read publicly, you have to do it in a deep voice that sounds like the guy who does the NFL highlight films. What the Bible does repeatedly affirm is that it is the primary way for humans to know and connect with their Creator, and so it should be read by anybody, and it should be made available to everybody so that everyone can read it. Now, that's a different perspective than what Mr. Larson has on the Bible, and I realize that, and you realize that, that I'm speaking as a Bible believer. But as a Bible believer, instead of being concerned about technology like Mr. Larson is, I am applauding technology. I am thrilled that the Bible is more widely available than it ever has been in the history of human civilization, and that people can easily access it everywhere at any time. That is a powerful and wonderful blessing. And again, I think Mr. Larson had to find something else to be concerned about. I think this is going to work for the Bible's good instead of being something that causes people to discard it.
You have been doing some traveling. You were in South Africa this month on a preaching mission, and then in June, I think, you've got a 7-night cruise to Alaska that you and your wife will be leading. I am trying to picture what, how you will bring what you're going to read on that cruise to Alaska, and if it's different than how you packed for South Africa.
Well, this is maybe a hard confession for me. I have become an iPad guy. And so my beloved Kindle keyboard is sitting on my dresser gathering dust, and I can't even remember the last time I cut it on. So when I went to South Africa, I went with my iPad and read and fully loved reading on it. And when I go to Alaska in June, it'll be the same. It'll be me and the iPad and all the books that the Kindle app can hold.
I have been speaking with Mark Roberts, who preaches at the Westside Church of Christ in Irving, Texas. Thanks very much, Mark.
Lynn, great to talk to you, and I appreciate so much the work that you do each week on the Kindle Chronicles.
In content, a while ago I made a resolution that I wasn't going to talk about books until I had actually finished them, because I've had the experience of getting very enthusiastic about a book and then halfway through, or by the time I get the end of it, having quite a different feeling. But I'll violate that rule and say that I'm finding The Etiquette of Illness, What to Say When You Can't Find the Words, to be a really helpful read in this setting where I'm back visiting with my folks and trying to be of some help to them in the situation that my father's in the hospital. The author is Susan P. Halpern, and she is a cancer survivor who is a great writer, and it's all about experiences of how you help people when they are facing medical trauma and difficulty, and do it in a way that helps maintain their dignity. Some fascinating stories. There was one that stuck in my mind where kind of a role play where one person would lead the other person around who was blindfolded, and the person that led was doing the leading felt great about the exercise. They felt like they were being helpful and kind and gentle and doing all this good stuff and getting a great feeling afterward. And the person being led around felt terrible. It just resented it and ended up thinking, you know, I'd rather just stumble into a rock than feel this helpless and at the mercy of this person that's helping me and feeling so good about it. So it's just filled with lots of insights that give you a chance to check how you're doing in the role of being a helper to someone, which is the case that a lot of us, many of us end up with our parents. And I made a few stumbles today, and I'm just going to try to do a little better tomorrow and head back trudge through the storm and the snow to the hospital and see if I can be a presence that's actually helpful. And you just want your love to be made visible in those situations, and to try to avoid having the ego just make a mess out of everything. So, The Etiquette of Illness, What to Say When You Can't Find the Words, by Susan P. Halpern, and I have a link to it in the show notes. That's it for this week. Whether your profession is the ministry or not, I'd appreciate prayers for my father and the kind of baffling array of health issues that he's facing, doing it with a lot of style. But his name is William, by the way. Sometimes I know that if somebody asks me to pray for somebody, it helps to know what their first name is. And He is a remarkable man. He's my hero in so many ways. And if there's any way I could summon prayers or energy that would help him turn this corner in a graceful way that results in a surprising recovery, that would make me feel very good. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles in snowy Cambridge, Massachusetts. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.